From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. On this show, part two of a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women at the table and on the menu. Respectability, politics, and tokenism in genocidal times.
Even if you are the top diaspora that has been integrated into every community, that is paying their taxes, that is upper middle class, and you go to vacation in Gaza to see your family for a birthday, for a graduation, the U.S. State Department is not showing up for you. They are bombing you and your family.
And do so-called inside strategies build power for our communities or sell out the movement?
To defy occupation, to defy colonialism, to defy this erasure of identity, that is powerful enough. And that, to me, helps define where our political power is in this moment.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. First, our headlines. At least 20 Palestinians were killed and more than 150 were wounded in northern Gaza City on Thursday after the Israeli military fired on a crowd of people waiting for food assistance. Gaza's health ministry called the attack, quote, a new premeditated massacre, end quote. The death toll is expected to rise as many wounded were taken to Al-Shifa Hospital, which has been rendered almost inoperable as a life-saving institution. This deadly attack is only the latest targeting of people waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza. A UN food distribution center in the southern Gaza city of Rafah was shelled by Israel on Wednesday, killing at least 5 people. Late last month, more than 100 people were killed and another 750 injured as they were waiting for flour to make bread in an area west of Gaza City. More than 111,000 people in Gaza are either dead, injured, or missing because of the Israeli attacks since October. Here in D.C., protesters disrupted a D.C. Council hearing on Wednesday, March 12th, protesting the refusal of D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson to allow consideration of a ceasefire resolution. Nene Tay, executive director of Harriet's Wildest Dreams, said that $15 million of federal taxes paid by D.C. residents go to apartheid Israel, and that D.C. police, as many U.S. police departments, train with the Israeli occupation forces, the military arm of the state now facing genocide charges at the International Court of Justice. Here are some of the voices from the action captured by On the Ground, beginning with journalist and activist Jacqueline Lukman, who interrupted the hearing and spoke from the audience to D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson.
I am upset that the first meeting the council is having on a baseball stadium, when there are thousands of children buried under rubble.
Starvation and ongoing genocide of the people of Gaza. Cease fire now!
Cease fire! Cease the council, pick a side! Cease fire!
Enough is enough. They shouldn't be supporting genocide anymore. They are supporting the killing of my cousins, my people in Gaza.
It is your business that they're spending your money, your tax dollars, to commit genocide. They are complicit. They are complicit, and we need you to say no more. Invest and divest from Israel.
Yes.
Invest in D.C. and divest from Israel. Hey.
And if they allow that to happen over there, what do you think they're allowed to happen here?
D.C. Council Chair Mendelson angered activists recently by telling them in a meeting that genocide in Gaza was, quote, inconsequential, end quote, to the business of the council. the D.C. Ceasefire Coalition, initiated by the Reverend Graylin Hagler and Faith Strategies, includes many D.C. activists and organizations, including Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Code Pink Women for Peace, and the Claudia Jones School for Political Education. And finally, the D.C. community and social justice communities near and far are mourning the death of Dory Latner, a veteran of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which were the shock troops during the 1960s fighting against Jim Crow apartheid in the southern United States. Latner was an enthusiastic supporter of newer generations of activists and a big fan of WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C., where she appeared as a frequent guest, offering news, commentary, and humor. She was 81 years old and will be missed. Rest in power, Dory Latner. And those are headlines and happenings. Up next, part two of our discussion on respectability politics. Stay with us.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
At the table and on the menu, respectability, politics, and tokenism in genocidal times was the subject of a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women on February 12, 2024. The panel includes Iman Abid, Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, Rama Kudami, Campaign Director at the Action Center on Race and the Economy, Iman Hassan, a civil rights lawyer who directs the Stop the School to Prison Pipeline program at Massachusetts Advocates for Children, and Mariam Durrani, a professorial lecturer at American University. The virtual panel was organized and moderated by Maha Hilal, an expert on institutionalized Islamophobia, the war on terror, and counter-narrative work. She is the author of the book Innocent Until Proven Muslim, Islamophobia, the War on Terror, and the Muslim Experience Since 9/11. She is founding executive director of the Muslim Counter Publics Lab. On this part two of our presentation, she begins with a discussion with Rama Kudami about U.S. administrations inviting Muslims to the White House during Ramadan at the same time that Israel is slaughtering Palestinians in Gaza.
Rama, you've recently reminded me that we're almost at the 10-year mark of one of the Obama administration's iftars, where the iftar was actually occurring during another bombing campaign of Israel in Gaza. And so having reminded me of that, you know, one of the thoughts I had and questions for you is, you know, what significance does this anniversary have in terms of where we are as a community in challenging state violence, and what this shows or demonstrates about, I would say, the obvious ineffectiveness, right, at best, of respectability politics?
I was remembering the anniversary mostly because I was like, oh, it's going to be Ramadan in less than a month now, and probably Biden's team is gearing up for an opportunity to make nice to Muslim communities, as he's been trying to do, and there'll be another opportunity potentially for organizing on this. But I remember 10 years ago when the call was made to boycott the White House iftar, the backlash that people had was that, you know, this call was causing fitna in our communities, division in our communities, that it wasn't proper adab i.e. etiquette, i.e. what I like to refer to when we talk about respectable politics within Muslim communities, this idea of like adab and what's the proper way to actually engage with each other. It was public call-outs like that were not an example of that. That we were, you know, the folks who were doing these calls and doing this type of organizing were folks who just like were couch activists, that they didn't really understand how the ins and outs of how government works, the inside strategy, all of that, that we could not comprehend that because we were not in those positions. And I think what we were actually pushing at the time and what those of us here today and those of us who are engaging and trying to get us to go beyond respectability politics is that we need more imagination in our organizing, in our strategy for us to actually get to what we want to get in terms of freedom for everyone, in terms of liberation for everyone. Because the limited strategies that respectability politics presents to us is not going to get us to a place where the U.S. isn't bombing our homelands, for example, and our families' homelands, isn't going to get us where Muslim men and boys aren't being imprisoned and tortured at Guantanamo. Back then, obviously, it was a much bigger population in Guantanamo. Guantanamo continues to be open. People continue to be held there. We're a world where we aren't okay with our civil rights being continuously violated because, oh, guess what? There's now actually some Muslims in some government positions. And so I think that's like what we were setting the stage for in that boycott call of like, we need to push our imaginations. And I think what we're seeing today is that, you know, being invited to meet with administrative officials behind closed doors, having the first Muslim this or that, having these officials come to our masajid and our community events doesn't really mean much if it is not building our power, as Iman was saying. Like, where does the power get built? From the bottom, from the top? And so instead, it just becomes a checklist. Like, okay, Biden met with this community, checklist, you know, whoever government officials checked. And so I think, and I'll end on this note, what we're seeing now, especially again, like the meetings that we keep talking about, Maha, you started the conversation tonight about like that one meeting that happened at the end, you know, a few months ago with the Muslim communities, some Muslim leaders and Biden, you know, supposedly having some feelings in that meeting. Well, one of the orgs that we know was in the room at the time, when last week's meeting happened in Michigan with Samantha Power, with, forget his first name, Finer, this org sent out an email saying, hey, we were in the room with this thing. And that's something I have not seen in the past. So even though it's not enough, and I think transparency is a much more needed among when these types of things happen, I think there it highlights, I think, one example for those of us who are pushing for these changes and go beyond structural politics, that you can't, that they are not even feeling they are able to keep these things secret anymore, that they're feeling the pressure that like, oh, maybe actually we do need to rethink our strategy.
So Iman H, you and I met actually at an anti-drone rally a couple years back. And as is typical with many of these sort of actions, right, we were the only two Muslims that were present. And my question for you, based on, you know, both the work I've done and the work you've done and our conversations together, is if you could talk a little bit about, you know, respectability politics and the ways it shows up in terms of who do we advocate for, right? So when we have communities or parts of our communities who are among the most criminalized, right, how does respectability politics show up in determining, right, and really shaping who it is, again, that we show up for and we advocate for and we protect the rights of?
Absolutely. And this is so deeply embedded in the war on terror. The language that is used in every single article about Palestine is about the setup that happened as early and even before 2001, but specifically 2001. A lot of that language allowed us to invade multiple countries, but also create the huge drone program that is terrorizing children and innocent civilians all over the world, and Muslims in particular. And as you've noticed, when we were together doing anti-war work in DC, I was at the Center on Conscience and War, specifically supporting soldiers that knew that waging war against innocent people no longer served their conscience and needed to leave through the legal mechanisms of conscientious objector. every time I went to those protests, especially drone protests or anti-war protests, I saw that our community wasn't there. And I think a lot of it is connected to, we know I have a lot of friends in my own like community, my own masjid, that is the internalization of what not to do and what it means to be a good Muslim, right? As long as you are disconnected from any narratives of terrorism, any acts that could be criminalized, you're good. And so that is in the psyche when you don't show up and fight against drone mechanisms that are bombing Somalia, that are bombing Yemen, that are bombing all of these countries. Because deep down, unfortunately, some of our community members do believe that even in Somalia and Mogadishu, if you are a good Somali person, you won't be hit by a drone. If you are not connected to Al-Shabaab, you're good, right? And that narrative around, especially Muslim men, which is unfortunate, our Muslim brothers from Gaza to Mogadishu to Yemen have had the most dehumanizing narrative around them. And so cleansing yourself of the proximity to terrorism in itself is something that has been internalized by our own community. And so when it comes to showing up, if that's through legal mechanisms, if that's through protest, or even just pushing back on the narrative, right? Why is it that I have to say Palestinian men deserve just as much humanity? And why is it that you have to say, no, they didn't vote for this and this entity that might be resistance or not resistance? Oh, no, they're doctors. I've seen that a lot, even within movement folks, right? When we post, we have to humanize them by saying that they graduated from this university. They were the best oncologists. They were the best teacher. They could have just been felons with 100 different felonies in prison. They do not deserve to be murdered. That's where we need to start. We need to undo the narrative of stating that only the best of the best deserve to have their humanity intact in this conversation around the dehumanization of Muslim folks all over the world. And unfortunately, in our different diasporas, we haven't done the work. But we recognize now that even if you're the best of the best, and even if you are the top diaspora that has been integrated into every community, that is paying their taxes, that is upper middle class, and you go to vacation in Gaza to see your family for a birthday, for a graduation, the U.S. State Department is not showing up for you. They are bombing you and your family. And why? Because the narrative already existed to say that you're always in proximity to terror, that you're already in proximity to being able to be droned without ever being connected to a crime, because your initial crime was being Muslim. And that is what we need to start talking about. And we need to protect our Muslim brothers, especially in Gaza, from having to be perfect to be human.
Thank you so much, Iman. I could not have stated it better myself. For Mariam, Dr. Durrani, my question for you is, you know, in your academic work, which has focused on challenging the war on terror through the lens of imperialism, what have you encountered in terms of other Muslim scholars' willingness to confront U.S. state violence on these terms? And what, again, of course, does that have to do with respectability politics and preserving the status quo?
Thank you so much for that question. And actually, I think it's a great segue from Iman's answer, thinking about kind of like how the different diasporas and their various politics that are based on their position as they come in shapes academia, right? So in many ways, a lot of the Muslim professors that you see in the university system are coming from various immigrant backgrounds, and they have been socialized to think that if you stay quiet, that you're going to stay okay. And that means that, for example, on campus, when students are being targeted, when other faculty are being targeted, they're not necessarily eager to speak up, if at all. And having gone through that experience myself of being targeted at my previous institution and kind of witnessing how not only Muslim scholars, but also scholars that claim to do work on racial justice and gender justice and thinking about social justice, it's very well and good to publish and write on these topics. But it's a very different situation when you're trying to actually dismantle these systems from within the university, especially as it's maintaining it. And we've been seeing that really in a pronounced way in the student protests against the genocide, right? So across college campuses, we're seeing how students are speaking up, how students are modeling for faculty how we should be moving within the university and not falling into these interpersonal conversations that colleagues try to have but that kind of displace what the issue is that's going on into kind of feelings, but actually maintain an analysis that sees how the university as a system is implicated in these relationships with Israeli universities. And how do we actually kind of address that from within and help our students understand and see what's happening in its entirety? I think it's also showing up in a lot of, you know, people have been talking about this on the socials in terms of how faculty who claim to be decolonial scholars are nowhere to be seen. So when it comes to kind of getting grant funding or kind of putting together conferences and panels, those titles abound. But when it comes to actually organizing within the university, it's a lot harder to get people to show up and kind of push those needles. And I think the last thing I'll say is that even in terms of my, you know, writing as an education scholar or an anthropologist and thinking about the impact of the war on terror, part of what I'm looking at is how we think about the racialization of Muslims, both within the United States, but then also thinking of the racialization of ethnic minorities, religious minorities in different contexts, who then are seen exactly as Iman was talking, as proxy to terror in those contexts, right? And how do we actually recognize that this is a global war that has inner wars and outer wars, as various scholars have said, and kind of think about dismantling both of these at both of their locuses, because that is critical, for example, in terms of seeing any kind of future liberation for everyone. And of course, it starts with Palestine. And that's key. I think many scholars have made that claim, and we need to kind of center that within the university as we're doing our work.
Thank you so much to all of you for your excellent remarks and perspectives. So I want to shift to a question for all of you. And to me, this is one of the most important questions. And the question is, how do you define political power? Because we talk about building power, whether it's within the halls of government, whether it's outside of government. But what actually does it mean, right? What does political power mean? How does it influence? How do we define it, right? How do we think about the ways that power, when we claim to have power, what does our claim really mean? Are we able to shift perspectives? Are we able to change policies? What does it actually mean? And if, I should add, Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims have political power, right? If we make that claim, what does it mean for us to be in the room with, for example, the Biden administration? What would be the difference of being in the room with political power versus without it? And how do we know we have power? What is the indication that we have actual political power to change the trajectory and outcome? And right now, what we're talking about, right, is Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people. So we'll go in the same order of Iman A, followed by Rama, followed by Iman H, followed by Dr. Jarani.
Specifically to the Palestinian community, like I cannot define political power without acknowledging its resistance. I cannot acknowledge the power if it wasn't for the Palestinians on the ground in Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, people like my mother who outlived occupation, who have been torn down in as many ways as possible. And in this moment have been torn down by a genocide, and still new generations have been bred. New generations have come. New generations have also been lost. But with each day that has passed, the resistance in some way has grown and the resilience in some way has grown. So to me, it says that the worst of the worst can potentially happen to the Palestinian people. And it is never, we don't necessarily need this atrocity. We don't need genocide in order to prove our worth, to prove our power through it all. But I think that there's a deep recognition that the Palestinian people are not going anywhere. We're always going to be where we are. We're always going to continue building on the foundations of strength that came before us. We've lived through 76 years. I've been saying 75 for so long, but we're already into the new year. This is 76 years of the Nakba. Our great-grandparents have lived through the Nakba. Our grandparents have lived through it. Our parents have now lived through occupation. And we ourselves are now bearing the consequences of occupation, whether we're on the ground in Palestine or part of the diaspora. And yet our demands and our stories have been heard louder than ever before. So I think for me, And you can't, I think when I was younger, I could perhaps say people, some people may not have known what Palestine was. I oftentimes got it confused with being Pakistani. But I think that was, of course, at the end of the day, this the racism that is so blatant that exists in this country. But at the reality at this point that, you know, and I've always found this to be quite powerful, is that the identity of being Palestinian, to even claim to be such, to be Palestinian, is one of the most powerful things in the world. To defy occupation, to defy colonialism, to defy this erasure of identity, that is powerful enough. And that, to me, helps define where our political power is in this moment. And I think when it comes time to Congress, I want to emphasize, again, we as an organization have targeted Congress on the daily for the last 120 plus days of this genocide. We have watched members of Congress say, well, we've never heard from Palestinians. We don't know what their demands are. We don't actually listen to them. To now having millions of calls, millions of voice messages, millions of emails that have been made to these people that they can no longer even say that they haven't heard from Palestinians or those in solidarity. And I think that that has been a huge win. In just 4 months, we got that to happen. And that's huge, because one of the reasons behind why oftentimes United States Congress members do not even take a chance to listen to us is because they claim that they haven't. And the reality is for many of us in the movement, we're up against a monster of a machine. I've been saying this repeatedly, right? Like we have the pro-Israeli lobbyist firm that has played a huge influence over these people and kind of really diminished our voices, even though our demands have not changed over the last decade. Around what it is that we've been asking for, the right of return, to end the occupation, to end the U.S. military funding to Israel. These demands have been loud and clear. It's just a matter of whether or not they've chosen to listen to them. And in this moment, we've almost forced them to take an opportunity to look into those demands. And I think that there's also something valuable, even though ceasefire has been the bottom line demand in this moment for us as a movement. But we know it's what the people of Gaza need, and it's what we have to continue pushing for. And there is a reality that we watched people who at first may not have wanted to sign on to the ceasefire resolution, to now over 60 plus members who have signed on to it because of the power of the people and the power of the Palestinian community being able to really uplift and center those demands all throughout this time of this genocide. So that's how I would answer this question.
Thanks, Iman. I think I'll add two main things. First, I think respectability politics tells us that like the power comes from accepting the situation as is and doing the best that you can. And so, you know, you do what the dominant folks in power need you to do in order to be accepted, and that will gain you power to then potentially make some demands that are within, again, this narrow end of what is acceptable. And, you know, sometimes people will buy into that because we don't have many choices in this U.S. system. The U.S. system is very broken, and people are like, well, within this and this, isn't it better to do X, Y, Z that will protect us in the immediate and we'll deal with the consequences later? The problem is you're setting yourself up potentially for even worse consequences in the future because you're not thinking from now like, no, we need to use our power, whatever it is, even if it's not that much, to lay the groundwork so that when we do have more power in the future, we can get exactly what we need in terms of full freedom, full liberation. And that requires, again, being very real about the what limitations we do have, but also acknowledging when we are able to accomplish things. Just like Iman just, the very specific example of Congress members slowly being pushed to demand a ceasefire. That takes a lot of energy and a lot of power, but it does showcase kind of what we can build. It also requires us to then talk about being part of wider movements that demand collective rights and liberation. It's not only about the Muslim community, which, by the way, the Muslim community is extremely diverse. So in general, you have to do that anyway. If you're within a Muslim context, you have to be talking about wider movements and other struggles because that's just the reality of the community it is. But again, you have, when you only consider like, well, I'm making demands of these folks in power and my power to actually change them is limited because the system is so messed up. No, let's, again, rethink the issue. The issue is there's more people, us as the people, are bigger in numbers than those in power. And so what is then the organizing that gets us to that point? And I think that the essential part of grassroots organizing, of political education, of understanding where of the many levers that we can pull. So again, we're in a moment in time where we know Biden is potentially worried about how people are reacting. How do we push him in this moment of time? Other people will tell you, no, like this is the moment to actually be nice to Biden because he's in power. No, that's not the moment to be nice to Biden. It actually gives you the opposite. And so I think there needs to be more reality check of where of doing this type of analysis. And the other thing I'll add, and this was sparked by the convo Maha and Iman H, you all had in terms of like, oh, showing up at things and there aren't any Muslim, other Muslim folks, whether it's drone stuff or anti-war stuff, et cetera. I've been in those situations too. part of it is us on our communities, but I also will push us to also think about our allies in those moments and what they're also putting forth. Because a lot of times our allies are looking at us as like, we are the people that need to be saved. And we make fun of the liberals who talk about Muslim women being saved, for example, abroad. Sadly, people, again, who should get it, even are within our allies, also have this same attitude that we're seen as the victims. And whether this is white saviorism or a bigger U.S. saviorism to the rest of the globe, where we don't have our agency. So we're put up as platformed as like, you tell the sad story and then we'll figure out the policies that will actually help you. And you tell us you come here, cry some tears, and then we'll figure out the engagement that needs to happen in order to rescue you. Instead of understanding like, no, we have agency and it might be messy. Organizing is not easy. It is messy. We're not a monolith, as several of us have brought. Like, it's not just something that's going to happen overnight. But you have to give us that space to do it, because if we're going to actually get to where we want to get to in terms of true liberation for all, it's going to take that time and engagement with our communities.
You're listening to the panel At the Table and on the Menu, Respectability, Politics, and Tokenism in Genocidal Times, a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women on February 12th, 2024, sponsored by the Muslim Counter Publics Lab. That last speaker was Rama Kudami. Before her, Iman Abid, Maryam Durrani, and Iman Hassan. This is On the Ground. I'm Esther Averam. Stay with us.
I think there's definitely an awakening happening. Unfortunately, that awakening is directly connected to the mass slaughter of our Palestinian brothers and sisters. And that is deeply disturbing every single day we wake up. But I also see, especially with the younger generation, I'm around Gen Z and Gen Alpha, they are activated. They are calling their Congress members. So there's electoral power that we hold. There's power as constituents, but there's also consumer power that especially the younger generation is really wielding, right? We know what happened to Starbucks. We know what's happening to McDonald's. We know what's happening to Puma. Power in our finances is real. And it's not just the Palestinian diaspora who holds that power, but it's also all of these different identities that connect to the Palestinian struggle and showing solidarity because they understand the power we hold with our wallet. And then there's also power through social media. There's power in just having the discourse that has been suppressed for decades. When I was in college, no one was having these very direct conversations about the slaughtering of Palestinians that has been happening every single day since I've been alive, right? But I have conversations with middle schoolers that come up to me and say, hey, Iman, when we walk out, what kind of demands should we have? And that might be in the suburbs of Massachusetts without a single Palestinian even being part of it. But there are young white students in Cambridge deeply disturbed with what's happening. That's power. And then there's also deep power in not engaging the communities that we have, right? I come from the 5th District of Minnesota, Minneapolis. I come from a deep, big Somali community, and we have power that we yield constantly, right? But then there's also the power of youth organizers and just the younger generation that is supposed to give their free labor come fall and go door knocking. I was one of those people, right? I was part of Students for Barack Obama going all over the Midwest and door knocking on behalf of the electoral power that is the Democrats without getting paid because I felt I had power with that. But when that generation doesn't feel like that they feel heard, seen, or reflected with their values in the Democratic Party, they are not going to spend their own gas money and be in the middle of who knows where, Minnesota, Michigan. I was in the middle of Iowa, not glamorous, but you have to feel like you have hope. And Democrats are not giving that generation any sense of hope. No one is giving you free labor without hope. And so that's the power that we have to really tap into right now.
So I think to answer the question about political power, I want to think about the power of the classroom and the power of what teachers and students are doing within universities, on college campuses, and high schools, as Iman was saying, in schools, and the way that they are organizing that space and making sure the conversation and the topic stays on Palestine. I also think that the students, they say very bluntly in classes that they get their information directly from the source rather than their parents that are kind of getting it filtered through corporate media. And so I think they're able to see the issues kind of in a much more direct way. And I do think that those are powerful mechanisms that, of course, people are kind of activating and drawing on, and something to really build on and think kind of creatively, as another panelist said earlier. How do we kind of think creatively with these opportunities of power that we have to think with together?
I know all of us have been in conversations, right, where if you challenge engagement with power, the rebuttal is, of course, per the title, that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Also that we need an inside-outside strategy. While this may be true, there doesn't seem to be one in place. And when that assertion is made, it's as if there is actually something coordinated that facilitates a change in policy and the violence that we are now seeing, for example, right, with Israel's genocide of the Palestinians. So I want to ask each of you to comment on what does an inside-outside strategy actually mean? And what would it mean if there was one in place for Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims in this moment? So I'm going to go in the same order.
Some could potentially answer that question and say, yes, there is a clear inside-outside strategy here. But I think that that's only true if the inside strategy was only capable of actually moving the needle in some way or another. And I think for me, you have to get to a point and you have to ask yourself, how much time do we allow to pass and how many patterns do we have to watch unfold before we decide for ourselves that perhaps working from the inside is actually no more, you know, is actually not going to provide us the opportunities that we thought that perhaps at one point it could. And I think at this point in particular, I want to mention these meetings that have been had with the Biden administration. Like, this is all intentional. These sorts of meetings themselves in this exact moment, let's recognize, are also happening during an election season when Michigan is at the forefront of what's happening in electoral politics. And I think that there's a recognition here that perhaps voters themselves have actually built, especially voters who support the Palestinian demands, have built enough power for themselves to be able to leverage how the election results may turn out. And I think that there's a deep acknowledgement that this isn't necessarily for the benefit of the community. These meetings aren't being had just because someone cares about what our community wants. It's clearly because does it allow, and respectability is on both ends, right? Like the people who choose to participate in these meetings and the people who are also hosting these meetings themselves. It's about building something that's only beneficial to oneself in some way, not beneficial necessarily to the movement. And I think that at this point, anyone who dares try to acknowledge that there is some sort of inside-outside strategy is really missing the mark on understanding that we've allowed 30,000 people to die with believing that we could actually change from within, when in reality, we should have stopped that strategy a long time ago, which is why Palestinians themselves in this moment have asked folks to stop meeting with administration. We've made that clear. And I think, again, we are not a monolith, and I cannot speak to what all Palestinians necessarily want. But we have watched how these sorts of strategies that get developed, or these meetings themselves that get held and people have now participated in, have also sidelined the demands of the movement. They are oftentimes, you know, used as an opportunity to co-opt demands. They're oftentimes used as an opportunity. And for many times, I actually want to acknowledge how often Palestinians themselves get conflated with Muslims, and we almost get used interchangeably in conversation, or, you know, oh, well, we met with the Palestinians, but perhaps not a single person carries a percentage of Palestinian blood that's in the meeting. But because they wear a hijab or because they identify as Muslim, it's almost as if they speak for the Palestinian community. And we know that's not true. And there's a deep anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia attached to that I want to acknowledge that goes hand in hand with it. So I think that, like, we watched, and this is not the first time. It's not like we're waiting to see, okay, now we've met with the administration, now what happens? We're now in a position where we've already seen this happen unfold many times before in the last 4 months genocide, that it's time to actually just stop this sort of strategy from continuing, because it's actually going to only further hinder the movement from achieving the demands it's asking for.
I think the only thing I'll add to Iman's points is that an inside-outside strategy isn't, there's folks doing things on the inside and then there's folks doing things on the outside. If you really want to build such a strategy And I agree fully with Iman saying in this moment in time, probably doesn't make sense to be doing that. But in other times, if we were building the strategy, the inside would be following the lead of the outside. That's what an inside-outside strategy to me is. It's we get to decide who's meeting with the administrative officials, not they get to decide who gets to be with them. We know who's meeting with them. There's full transparency about what the discourse is. There'll be live streams of these meetings in ideal worlds. Like, that's where. And I don't think any of us, again, here will tell you that, like, engaging in Congress is bad or, like, or engaging in general with the people who are elected to represent us is a bad strategy. The problem is it's not done in a way that actually uplifts the demands of the grassroots of our community. It's done with, here's someone is choosing these people. It's happening behind closed doors. And maybe we find out about it. And then when we find out about it, we don't even know what actually was discussed, what was agreed upon, what's the timeline to actually meet these demands. When, if those demands are met, what then is the next step? It's just, oh, we met. And that in and of itself becomes the goal versus any actual organizing and campaigning around the demands. And the fact is, many times people, again, on the inside doing that work, chastise those on the outside when we say we need more agitational strategy, whether that's protests or boycotts or radical political education. And that to me proves that this inside strategy is actually seen as a way to clamp down on the outside strategy, not as a way to like feed into each other.
What's fascinating is that the power that comes from the work that is being done from the outside is used from the people that want to have these meetings, right? Like the meeting is happening because the Biden administration is now realizing, uh-oh, we might lose the masses here. We might lose the different diasporas. We're losing Palestinian voters, Muslim voters, voters that are in solidarity with these communities. And then for the people that are wielding that power from the work that is done by the organizers, activist community members, to make a decision on behalf of the community is the most perverse act of organizing, right? And I think when Palestinian organizers, voices, and community members, some of which have lost many, many family members are telling you, don't meet with the administration. And you meet with the administration, you're doing it to co-opt the power that was created by them, not because you're centering the needs of the community, right? And I think to be at the table means nothing when the minimum ask is not even entertained by the administration. And the minimum ask is stop slaughtering civilians that are caged into a tiny, tiny space. And can I just say, that is the tiniest, tiniest ask that I've ever heard from a community. Like, stop a genocide. And if the Biden administration can, from a negotiation point, start at that, you won't get anything from them. You get less than crumbs. You don't even get your humanity. And so there is no inside strategy until that has actually been put on the table. And I'm sorry, I'm from the 5th District and I love Keith Ellison, but for him to be part of the meetings in the fall, like that's how ludicrous this is getting. Like we have the AG who is Muslim, identifies as a Muslim man, meet on behalf of the Muslim community. You are an attorney general of a state. How disruptive can you be? How radical can you be? And how demanding are you for the Palestinian community? And that is what I have to really, really be critical of. All of us should be critical of. When you see at the table, Muslim community members or Palestinian community members that are using the power of the people without listening to the demands of the people.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to just add from the microcosm of the college campus where I'm situated in terms of these demands that have been made of various universities to do better by their Palestinian students and the student movements on campus that have been banned and restricted and policed by various members on campus and how that has not been addressed. And I think What I'm seeing now is that there is a refusal to engage with university leaders unless they meet, again, the bare minimum demands that are being made of them in that situation. And I think that, again, as a microcosm, can kind of expand out to exactly like there are certain mechanisms that should be available to those of us who are participating in the institution. And if they are not, and if that is something that we realize, then what are we going to do about that? And how do we respond to that collectively? And I think doing it collectively and with community is critical because, again, for those of us who are learning from Palestinian organizers on how to proceed, we await the decisions that are being made and how we can support each other best.
So we're running short on time, so I'm going to just ask our panelists one or two more questions before I also ask Iman A to guide us through and tell us about actions we can take now to stop Israel's genocide. But because a couple of you at least have touched on the upcoming election cycle and Biden's disingenuous, his administration's disingenuous pleas now, right, to our communities. My question is, you know, in what ways are we sort of re-entrenching the dehumanization of our communities if we're engaging on the premise of our vote matters, right? So we're talking about, right, the ways that we can leverage our power. And in some ways, when we say our power can be leveraged through the vote, that can be effective, but it can also, right, lead to this idea that we're only worth considering because of our votes. So how do we sort of push this conversation deeper, right? So it doesn't default to this being used as a strategy of dehumanization. And are there examples you can think of in which the power of the vote has been and is being successfully leveraged in terms of any sort of campaigns that you're aware of?
Yeah. One thing that I want to acknowledge is I think for the first time, we're actually able to leverage this sort of political power in a way that the Palestinian movement hasn't been able to do before. I mean, to even say that we are a voter constituency that to some degree matters is something that I don't think that we ever had at the forefront of our messaging and talking points, or we ever thought we could use as a framing to help leverage anything that we need. And it feels disgusting to oftentimes have to dilute ourselves to that point and reference that, like, our demands are only worth as important as they are to keep you in office. Like, there's a reality that it's also we've gone so far into this genocide that I don't even know if people make different political decisions, I could choose another option at the table for how or what happens within their tenure, whether or not they choose to come back into office or not. And like, I think that there's power in that. I think the reality is that when it comes to like the Palestinian movement and our demands specifically, oftentimes they're centered on this idea that we are deserving of a life that is free of occupation and free of this genocide that's been unfolding that actually has nothing to do with voting for a candidate or another. And I think it's more around the fact that there's also this sense of morality that the United States should be considering when it comes to identifying and uplifting the demands of the Palestinian people. I think it's been mentioned here time and time again, like Iman, you were mentioning it right just a couple minutes ago, is that like, we're not even getting crumbs. We're not even getting crumbs from this administration. So why do we even think that in any way, shape or form, if these people continue to be in office, we think that we could actually get our demands met at this point or another? And I think there's an acknowledgement of that, but I think that there's a deep acknowledgement that our demands are really centered in like this idea of being, that this is a life-affirming movement. This is a movement that is dedicated to understanding and bringing attention to the fact that what has been unfolding in Palestine does not need to continue. It does not need to remain as is. And so I think that, you know, I completely understand this dilution of like our own dignity and as we acknowledge ourselves as voters, quote unquote. But I think the reality is too, is that this is a new point and opportunity for us as well as a movement at this time.
I think what I'll add is our role as voters, and I think someone had also asked a question around like the local level. I think that's I would push us to think about this being an issue that goes beyond just like the White House and Congress. Obviously in the media it is the ceasefire, you know, who's going to actually push for a ceasefire is on that level. But elected officials all across the various levels of government can also make these types of demands. And we saw there was a letter of hundreds of local elected officials around the country signed on demanding a ceasefire. And so I think another way to I would think about this is like, what can you do locally in addition to as you're engaging Congress to make these demands? Because this is a local issue. Palestine is a local issue. It's not only about foreign policy. That's the way they like to mix the excuse of like, oh, no one cares about foreign policy. That's why we're not going to care about this issue. But it's not. We know it's not a local. We know we're all complicit in different ways. I'll give one example. Since October 7th, state governments, municipal governments have invested hundreds of million dollars in Israel bonds. Israel bonds is like a loan to the Israeli government, i.e. state and municipal governments are giving money to Israel that it then uses to commit genocide against the Palestinian people. Why are local governments doing this? And so these are the types of questions. And again, goes back to the money angle, goes back to the corporate angle. This type of mapping is so important. And why, when we're talking about, you know, why the need for organizing is so important, particularly on a local level, because that's how you kind of bring the issue home. And it's a lot of times much easier to make that impact locally than on a national level. But we know all these small impacts on a local level do eventually lead to impacts across the globe.
I think the power that comes from different movements and different spaces of liberation work, understanding that their liberation is very much connected to the liberation of Palestinians right now, to this moment, is where the power stems from, right? We know that Zionism and the violence that comes from Zionism and white settler colonialism cannot coexist with Black liberation. It cannot coexist with feminism. It cannot coexist with disability justice. It cannot coexist with repo justice. It cannot coexist with labor movements. So if you bring together the power of all of these movements that are doing the work, that's where the power really comes in when it comes to electoral politics. I hope that the Muslim community in itself is a powerful coalition that can show that we can wield power in this election. But the real power comes from Black churches calling out Biden already now, right? Like we've seen in South Carolina, we've seen in the Southern Belt, Black churches coming out and saying the slaughtering of Palestinians is deeply disturbing, right? And we know Biden cares about those votes. We know what that means for Black communities to stand up and say Black liberation is connected to undoing this violence, for repro justice movements or immigration rights movements to come out in coalition with this group of voters is critical as well. And that is happening. I see it on the ground. We're meeting with Black union organizers. We're meeting with disability rights groups. We're meeting with repo groups. We're meeting with immigration rights groups. We're meeting with decriminalization and in the United States, groups that are anti-prison work, right? Abolitionists. All of these coalitions are coming together and recognizing that in this moment, if we can dehumanize any group of people at this level, that dehumanization crosses boundaries and borders, right? We know I'm a Minneapolis girl. The police in Minneapolis, their training comes, we know that we've seen the Ferguson to Palestine. We've seen Minneapolis to Palestine. Palestine was sending us information on how to protect our lungs when things were thrown at us, everything from gas to how to wash our faces. That was coming directly from solidarity work we were doing with Palestine. Ferguson had the same thing happening. I think Black liberation movements have known for a really long time that it's critical to undo the white settler violence that is happening abroad, because unfortunately, a lot of what's happening, the testing of violence on Palestinian bodies, is then imported to our local movements. It's brought, that violence is just replicated and used on indigenous bodies, on disabled bodies here. It's used on Muslim bodies here and Black bodies. And so we really have to be critical on bringing this power in to both electoral power, but also understanding that undoing the violence in Gaza is the work that we need to be doing in all of those movement spaces.
Thank you all so much. Unfortunately, we are pretty much at the end of our program, but I wanted to hand the floor to Iman A to talk to us a little bit about the work of U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, especially the Quit Genocide Campaign and other initiatives and actions we can take right now to stop the genocide of the Palestinians.
Yeah, thank you. I'll speak to the Stop Genocide campaign. I think I want to acknowledge that we are doing in collaboration with Adela Justice Project. And one of the things that I'm so grateful, we've been talking about respectability. And I think we acknowledge that this specific moment in time requires this level of strategy and this approach. And I think at this point, 4 months out since this genocide in Gaza has begun, we've had to ensure that people who have been working for these administrations are actually being held accountable in the same light as those who are leading these institutions. That for anyone who's participating in these administrations is also held responsible for the bloodshed that has happened across Gaza. And I think that there is an acknowledgement that we understand. I mean, all of us have to work. We live in a capitalistic society. But I think the reality is, in this exact moment, to be working for this administration in this moment, we have not been able to leverage any internal shift, any internal policy shift from the inside. And so people should be stepping down and resigning from these positions as an act of solidarity with the Palestinian people, to remind them that they are also responsible in this moment. And especially after the ICJ ruling, are responsible for what Israel has been committing. Now there's a deep formal statement that has been made by the highest court in the world at this point, that has chosen to take a stance on what has been going on. And so we've really had to amp up our pressure on what has been going on and encourage folks to take a stand, to actually choose to take the lead as other leaders have done, whether it be folks like Tariq who've left from the White House, or Josh Paul who've left from the State Department. There are many folks who have chosen to take that position. We want to encourage folks to continue doing so. Additionally, we have a toolkit that actually outlines a number of ways in which we hope folks can get involved in their localities. It's while the target in some of these cases around our actions requires folks to target members of Congress, there's also an immediate thing that you could be doing at the local level, whether it be trying to pass a ceasefire resolution or going beyond that and passing some sort of divestment resolution to stop the funding towards Israel. Like, we are in a position right now that if you have passed a ceasefire resolution, the time is this moment to organize around divestment or to start targeting local weapons manufacturers who are participating in this system. There are many targets at the local level that are actively participating in this genocide, and we encourage folks to mobilize, either join local coalitions, use our tools to help guide you, and to also start leveraging some of those demands that we are making at the national level. They look the same nationally. I think that people also have the opportunity to shift a lot more at the local level, which is really, really beautiful, and encourage folks to continue participating in it. But if any folks have any questions, please do contact us at contact@uscpr.org, and we'd be happy to try to assist you in any local work that you're pursuing.
I want to thank all of you, Iman H, Rama, and Dr. Durrani, for really providing a robust discussion and helping us think through how we move in this particular moment, at this particular juncture in time, and what it means to build political power, what it means to engage, and where do we go from here?
And that was Maha Halal, founding executive director of the Muslim Counter Publics Lab, closing out the panel, At the Table and on the Menu, Respectability, Politics, and Tokenism in Genocidal Times, held February 12th, 2024. And that will do it for today's show. I want to thank Maha Halal and all her participants on the panel for allowing us to bring their voices to you on our broadcast. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, on 24 stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, on all your podcast platforms at On the Ground with Esther Averam, and on our website, onthegroundshow.org. In addition to communicating with us on the website, you can let us know you like the show on Twitter, Facebook, and on patreon.com/onthegroundshow. Or I also link to every show on my Instagram page, which is Esther, ESTHER_Averam, V like Victor, ERM like Mary. The music we played this hour included Leve Palestina from the Palestinian Swedish band Kofia, and that's from the album Palestina Midland. I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free by Nina Simone. And our theme music is Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix. I'm Esther Averam. Until next time, take good care and keep raising your voice. Peace. On the Ground is a totally listener-sponsored, supported show, and we are in need of your support. If you rely on the show, if you listen to the show, you come to look forward to what we are able to offer every week, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/onthegroundshow. And you can also give on our website through PayPal or other means if you want to send a check. All that information is there. But please, please support us. I want to thank our supporters on Patreon so much. And for those who are already supporting, if you can tell a friend who you know would love to sign up, we need the support. Patreon.com/onthegroundshow or go to onthegroundshow.org. Thank you.